Mr. Hernandez?
Good morning, Judge.
Good morning.
My name is Clay Hernandez, and I represent the appellant, Camilo Mendez-Garcia. I'd like to reserve 7 minutes. Our position is that the government, in this case...
Can you speak up just a little bit?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. Our position is that the government, in this case, paraded in front of the jury a list of prior bad acts established or connected to my client, the appellant, only by unsubstantiated innuendo. And they did that through their chief and really only witness to this, to these acts, Ms. Gilliland. She was a cooperating defendant. And when the court is considering the facts of this case and how they apply, I'd ask the court to keep in mind a couple of things with regard to this individual. Ms. Gilliland, at the time of her stop and arrest at the port of entry in Arizona, denied wholeheartedly any knowledge or involvement in this marijuana operation that she was allegedly a part of, or that she was a part of. They found 600 pounds of marijuana in the motorhome titled in her name that she was driving. It was only when she was confronted with a statement from her son. She was a passenger. Her son was driving. They separated them as they want to do. And only when confronted with a statement by her son that, yeah, that's what they were doing and they were transporting this marijuana, did she decide to come forward and cooperate, if you will, with the government. I point that point out because at the beginning of this investigation, she wasn't being truthful with the government. At the end of the investigation, a couple days later, when they put this vehicle in a military cargo plane and transported it all the way to Washington State, she was going to deliver it to allegedly to my client, Mr. Mendez-Garcia. She never did that. She drove around out in the boonies up in Pasco, Washington, a big farming area, and drove around for several hours. In fact, she got stopped by a local deputy driving around up there and never was able to deliver this marijuana to the people that she said she was supposed to. They finally just called the whole thing off. Mr. Mendez-Garcia was arrested a few days later. But it doesn't stop there. The credibility of this witness, you go on and look at 6 weeks before trial, which happened about 2 years later, she mentions to the government for the first time, oh, by the way, I was selling marijuana myself in that area and selling this marijuana that I was supposedly transporting, that I'd supposedly been paid with. Myself, I was a dope dealer in the Pasco, Washington area.
All of this you were able to cross-examine on?
I was able to cross-examine her on that.
In fact, on the one thing that apparently the government didn't tell you about prior to trial, that she had been paid in the past, part in cash, part in controlled substances, the district court offered you an opportunity for a recess and to conduct further investigation, didn't you?
Judge, the court said we would discuss it. The court never actually offered it to me. And I'd ask the court to keep in mind this, because when you look at that time to put off, we're in the third or fourth, fifth day of trial. All of these actions took place in Washington State. This trial takes place in Tucson, Arizona. We don't have the ability or means to go in and then conduct an investigation or an appropriate investigation. We did what we could over the phone during recesses, but we weren't able to go back to Pasco, Washington, and conduct any sort of information. I'm sorry, investigation.
Did you ask for a recess,
Judge? I asked for a mistrial
Did you ask for a recess?
No, sir. I did not. I did not ask for a recess. I did not believe, I'll tell the court, I did not believe that a recess would be granted. My motion for a mistrial specifically requested to, in order to be able to obtain more information and the time required, I believed, to conduct an appropriate investigation. When the court looks at these prior bad acts evidence, and that's what I wanted to focus on first with the court's permission, the court has Ms. Gilliland, and she's the person I've described to the court to this point. The government makes much use during that time of the actions that she supposedly was engaged in back in May of the same year when she was arrested in November. And they talk about a number of things that that supposedly substantiate her testimony or authenticate her testimony, if you will. And I'd like to go through a few of them for you if I can. One of the things they talk about is, well, she obtained a cell phone with money that she obtained from my client. These are statements that she made. These are statements that she told us about. There's no evidence other than her testimony that that was the source of the cell phone, the reason for the cell phone, or the history to the cell phone. The cell phone is some...
Go to her credibility, which the jury had an opportunity to... You had an opportunity to cross-examine her, and the jury had an opportunity to see her on the stand and to judge her credibility, right?
The court's correct. It goes to her credibility, but saying that I got the chance to cross-examine her is prophylactic, if you will, or it took care of any problems with that. I think it either puts the cart before the horse or it skirts the issue. In that, what are my alternatives? I can't have her take the stand and not cross-examine her about these things. I did what I was able to do under the circumstances, because all of this information that she put forth, which we submit was unsubstantiated completely, was nonetheless put forth before the court. In my brief, I believe I indicate that her testimony about that first trip, which my client wasn't charged with, was a day and a half. I'm sorry, her testimony was a day and a half. Her testimony about the first trip was an entire day. And the evidence we have of her first trip is, one, the cell phone, two, money that she allegedly received from my client. And that money, if the court will look at the exhibit, is my client's name written on the back of an envelope or a brochure from a hotel in Mexico, along with a confirmation number to obtain money. My client's name is written on the document, but she tells us where the money came from, where the phone call came from, who put the money in the account and mailed it to her. There's no independent evidence of that. It is her testimony as to how that money was allegedly transferred to her on the first trip. She likewise says that first trip had to do with an RV full of marijuana. The only evidence we have is the government's record of the motorhome going through the port of entry in May. We don't even know if she's in it. There's no evidence to show that she's even in it.
Except that she's testified that she's in it. I mean, all of these, in some respect, counsel, are admissions against her interest, because they allow you to impeach her as someone who has previously engaged in bad acts and is admitting to engaging in criminal conduct.
But
that gives you an opportunity to impeach her character, and gives you an opportunity to question her.
I get to impeach her character and cross-examine her, but what they're doing is putting her prior bad acts, of which there's no connection or no validation with regard to...
Was this the same motorhome that she drove?
It was the same motorhome.
And the motorhome clearly was purchased by your client, and it's titled in her name.
It's purchased by my client about nine months earlier.
Okay, right. But it is purchased by your client. We clearly have a paper trail connecting the motorhome to your client, from your client to Ms. Gilliland.
Well, except the court's correct. There's somewhat of a paper trail. However, I'd ask the court to keep in mind that the motorhome, while it's titled in, it was purchased by my client, according to the witness from Washington. It's not titled in my client's name, and Ms. Gilliland indicates she fraudulently titled and prepared fraudulent documents to title the motorhome in her name. So I think the paper trail pretty much stops at the time of the purchase of the vehicle. I don't know that the paper trail is as tight or is as clear as the government would have the court believe.
You had indicated you wanted to say
something. Yes, and that's what I was just going to ask.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Hernandez. We'll hear from the government at this time. Mr. Ferg?
May it please the Court, my name is Bruce Ferg, Assistant United States Attorney on behalf of the government in this case. Very simply stated, our position is that the prior uncharged act evidence was properly admitted on a couple of different grounds, and secondly, that there was, in fact, no Brady violation. Now, I can go through a detailed legal analysis, but I think the crux of Mr. Hernandez's argument so far has been that there was no corroboration present for the validity of Ms. Gilliland's statements about this earlier uncharged May incident. First of all, you don't need corroboration. As I pointed out in my brief, There are a number of cases, including those from the Ninth Circuit, which say the evidence of one person, as long as they are appearing in person and are subject to cross-examination, is a sufficient basis for the admission of this kind of evidence. But more than that, there is, in fact, corroboration of various parts of her story. First of all, the cell phone, it's not just a matter of her having a cell phone, although they are not discussed at length in the trial itself. They were discussed in the prosecuting ASUA's closing argument, that the cell phone records actually show continuous, ongoing conversations back and forth between Ms. Gilliland and the defendant, beginning in April, all the way through the period of the charged episode in November.
When did the government learn that Gilliland had been paid in part in the past with drugs?
Apparently only about 2 weeks before the actual trial. The AUSA, when this came up in the course of...
You didn't try the case?
No, sir, I didn't.
Who did?
A lady named Maria Avila, or Davila, excuse me. And she, when this came up in the course of the examination of Ms. Gilliland, and there was a sidebar discussion, she indicated that she had first learned that part of the payment to Ms. Gilliland was actually in marijuana and not just straight cash about 2 weeks before, when she had been interviewing her prior to some pretrial motions.
Why wasn't it disclosed?
Apparently, it was simply an error in judgment. What she states in the record was that because it had been disclosed that, in fact, Gilliland had been paid by the defendant, she simply didn't perceive that there was anything additionally inculpatory about the fact that it was marijuana as opposed to straight cash.
You're clearly wrong about that, right?
Yes, sir. I'm, in hindsight, obviously, it is something that could have been developed further, as was, in fact, done by way of impeachment.
So are you sticking by your prior argument that there was no Brady violation?
Yes, in the sense that Brady requires a number of things. Particularly, Brady is based on the idea...
Let's start. It was not disclosed, right?
Well, yes and no. Because Brady contemplates a complete lack of disclosure.
Well, for 2 weeks from the time she knew it until the time counsel was told it was not conveyed, right?
But Brady contemplates, for example, a case where evidence is kept so hidden that you only find out about it after trial. And there are numerous cases from this court saying that even if it's disclosed mid-trial, as long as...
The reason we have Brady is to enforce the government to turn square corners.
Absolutely.
And just because it hurts the government's case, in fact, a compelling argument can be made that when it... Precisely because it does hurt the government's case is the reason that compels its disclosure. Now, what the district court did when it found out may have ameliorated against the nature of the violation, but I must tell you, as a former federal prosecutor myself, I don't find any equivocation here. This was a Brady violation.
There was a lack of disclosure, and that's certainly the kind of situation.
Just say it. I mean, I take it your stronger argument is there any Brady violation was cured by what the district court offered to be done and had done, and part of which the defense didn't take advantage of. But to argue that it wasn't a violation seems to me just to be outside the line.
Well, perhaps it's because I understand there are certain technical elements of a Brady violation, including whether or not, in fact, there has been...
...do with the government telling the truth, right?
Certainly, my understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that for a Brady violation as defined by the Supreme Court, it's not just a lack of disclosure, but, in fact, whether it was a lack of disclosure at a point in time or to a point in time where the defense was not able to effectively use the information. And as this court has already been discussing with Mr. Hernandez, he was, in fact, able to learn about it and cross-examine in a highly effective way.
Told 2 weeks in advance, he could have gone to the district judge and asked to continue the trial date. I take it he's CJA?
I believe so, yes.
He could have asked for investigative funds to go up to Washington and find out if Ms. Gilliland was some preyed upon errant mother who was doing this for economic reasons, or some major league drug dealer from the Pacific Northwest bringing in massive amounts of drugs and making a lot of money from it, and which would have been a perfectly appropriate subject of cross-examination, right?
He was given that opportunity, and he did not
during the trial.
And this Court says that's okay. If he felt that he needed more, he could have come back to the Court, as he had been invited to do, and say, I need more time. But in fact, when the Court asked him, what kind of things would you have developed if you'd been told this 2 weeks ago, he basically said there were two things, how much she received and what did she do with it. And
all the prosecutor had to do was, the minute she found out about it, pick up the phone and call counsel.
I'm not disputing it.
Or send a letter, right?
In no way am I disputing it, Your Honor. It should have been done. Again, perhaps it's a semantic difference, but because of my understanding of what Brady requires, I didn't see it as that.
We understand your argument, and I think you get the message.
Yes, sir. And I will convey it, certainly.
Do you have anything further?
Well, there is the 404B evidence. I would just briefly indicate.
You've covered that in your brief, haven't you?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why don't we hear rebuttal? Thank you very much, Mr. Berg.
Judge, I believe Mr. Ferg is correct. It was 2 weeks. I said 6 weeks. I apologize. What I'd ask the Court to consider are a couple things with regard to Brady.
I ask you to speak up.
I apologize. One of the things I'd ask the Court to consider with regard to Brady is this case is rises and falls with their cooperating defendant. And I believe that when you have a case that is so keenly tied to someone of that nature, that Brady, the interpretation of Brady and the enforcement of Brady ought to be strict. And as a result, I think that there are issues with regard to what she did with that marijuana that were a Brady violation. I believe we were prejudiced by that. In preparing for this argument today, I look back at the Court, and we always have hindsight. I did try the case. But we always have hindsight as maybe we should have done something better. It would have been a much different argument to stand before the jury and say, you know what, this is a lady who is a dope dealer. She provides her own dope, and then she sells it in the Pasco, Washington area, versus some lady who was preyed upon by my client to make a trip and make some money. And when we did our opening statements and when we had our theory of the case, it was basically that she was saying these things to save her own skin with somebody that she knew, not that she was a dope dealer that sold the marijuana that she brought in. And I think that those are completely different or very different arguments. I will also tell the Court that I did travel to the Pasco, Washington area pre-trial. I think about 2 to 3 months prior to that time, to meet with the client, to look at the scene, to talk to the people that I could, as far as witnesses go. And the issue of what you find out in trial, halfway through a trial, Judge, in the years I've been doing this, you ask for a mistrial. If you get the information before trial, you ask for continuance, but I can't tell the Court that I've ever had a significant – I've tried cases in other jurisdictions where, in a federal court, I've asked for a continuance and I've been given a weekend. But it was something that took place in that jurisdiction. It wasn't something that took place 1,500 miles away or 1,000 miles away. And as a result, Judge, I believe the mistrial was the only appropriate alternative at that time, and that's why we sought it in order to be able to obtain the information that I thought we could potentially find. Those are the issues I have, unless the Court has anything else.
I don't see any other questions. Counsel, thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Thank both sides for their argument. The case just argued will be submitted for decision. We'll proceed to the last case on the calendar this morning, which is the United States against Eppes. Counsel will come forward, please.